Any life is going to take a few twists and turns. We might make plans to run General Motors or play professional baseball, but life and other interests and other circumstances intervene. Today's guest appeared to be on the way to a life as a concert pianist. Greta Beagle was very good and very well regarded as a child in South Africa. Didn't quite get there. And there are lots of details in The Why, which she relates in her memoir, Kvetch, One Bitch of a Life. Greta Beagle worked for a long time at the Los Angeles Times as an arts reporter and editor. She has contributed to the New York Times and Oregon Jewish Life and other publications, and has written another book, the rhyming satire Musings, My Life as a Jewish Cat. She lives in Ashland now. Greta Beagle, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
You mentioned on Facebook the oddness of having, in the form of the book, your life essentially in the palm of your hand. Explain that.
Yes. I originally published Kvetch as an e-book. And I found it relatively easy, and I was pretty detached, and, you know, it was terrific having my book. And I must say, publishing my story in paperback has proved a tremendous shock. It's a stunning psychologically, emotionally, physically. It's very, very different than publishing digitally. First of all, you literally have your life in the palm of your hands. Second of all, you have to do a lot of proofing. Now, if you've read my book, you've seen there's quite a bit of emotional abuse there and dysfunctionality. Mm-hmm. And you have to proof it again and again and again. In a way, it's good because you end up realizing that all the characters that you took so seriously are, as the bard said, merely playing a part on a stage. So that's a little bit healing. So it's pretty stunning emotionally, and I don't think I've even come to terms with it yet. It's very, very different than an e-book.
In an e-book, there just isn't as much proofing?
You do proof an e-book, but once you've done it and you're satisfied with it, you put it up, you upload it, and then I spend most of the time making sure it looked good. There's coding, there's making sure it looked good, the appearance, it's terrific. I was completely detached from the e-book, and this is so vastly different, it's a shock.
It really is right there in the palm of your hands.
Yes.
And the impact did finally wear off after time, just a bit of it.
Yes, one of the miracles I've noticed, and it's very strange, I don't know if it happens with other writers, I live every word until I publish. And then I notice about 2 weeks later, I'm not even sure what's up there anymore. Like, for example, knowing we were doing the interview, I spent the weekend reading my book just to make sure I remembered everything.
Well, so we both got familiar with the book then. The book does start in South Africa. Where are you and your parents? Where are your parents from originally? Let's ask that question.
My father was born in Riga. And I've written a short story called A Jew from Riga. Mm-hmm. I went to Riga. I went to Latvia to try and trace his mysterious past. And I'd stumbled upon the most incredible museum of occupation. And I realized that the borders with Riga and Latvia were very, very in flux, always changing. So he was born in Russia per se. But it was still part of Latvia, was part of Russia. Then he moved to Vilnius, which was Lithuania. Then they moved back to Riga. So it was very much in flux, but he is a first-generation Russian. My mom was born in Pretoria, the capital of South Africa, but her parents were from Russia.
All right. So definitely Eastern Europeans generally,
yes,
ethnically, but then your mother was born in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a very big Jewish community in Johannesburg?
Yes, there was an Orthodox. I grew up Orthodox, a very religious, very devout community in Johannesburg and in Cape Town to some extent. I'm always amused when people say to me, "You mean there were Jews in Africa?" But some people have said to me, you know, were there lions in the street? So I guess, you know,
right,
can expect anything.
How big a Jewish community are we talking about? Because I must admit it was a surprise to me as well. I mean, particularly when we're talking about apartheid era South Africa here,
right,
and Jews.
I'm not sure of the statistics. Mm-hmm. I don't know the exact numbers, but I know it was a very substantial community in South Africa, supported many, many synagogues, supported Israel.
Mm-hmm. And how old were you when you took your first piano lesson? This is a major, major theme of the book.
I think I was age 5. And by age 7, I was just, you know, this prodigy, and I was performing and concertizing and doing our Stedfords, and was a real whiz kid.
Mm-hmm. So instant results, obviously, but how did it feel to you? Do you remember the feeling you had when you first got just a little bit of instruction and where you went with it from there?
Well, the thing that astonishes me, and I think it's true of most prodigies, is you have instant, terrific technique. instant flexibility, just instant. So it was no challenge to me. I mean, I could just play. It was fluid. It was terrific. And I loved it. I felt very powerful at the piano. Not on an upright, however. It had to be a baby grand. There's a very, very different feel for me. At a baby grand or grand, I feel very expansive. The power comes from his shoulders. You have room. Uh-huh. You know, I can still feel that now as I'm talking to you. I can see myself there. Whereas an upright, it's very restrictive. It's very amateurish. But most kids start out with uprights. But I would encourage parents of talented children, if they can afford it, to switch to a baby grand or grand pretty early on.
Well, that's curious. Sitting at the upright, did it feel like you were working at a desk or something?
Yes, it's very insignificant.
All right, we're talking to Greta Beagle about her book, Kvetch, One Bitch of a Life. It involves the fact that she was apparently headed toward a career as a concert pianist, and it didn't turn out to be that way. She ended up working as a journalist, among many other pursuits. We'll come back and talk more with Greta and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Greta Beagle. She is now a resident of Ashland, but has been a resident of many other parts of the world, and she tells us quite a bit about her life and some of the challenges she's faced along the way in her book, Kvetch, One Bitch of a Life, a memoir of music and survival. Greta came from South Africa, from a Jewish community there, and ended up in the United States. Thought she was going to be a concert pianist at one time, so did the rest of the world, and then that didn't quite happen. She spent many years working for the Los Angeles Times as an arts reporter. But we'll find out more about Greta as the hour goes ahead. You can join us with questions and comments at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we're just talking about probably getting your first piano lesson at age 5. Quite the prodigy, very good at it in very short order. But I get the sense from what you write that it began to feel like a job very quickly to you as well.
Yes, I was a super talent. And there are many, many factors. I write this in one chapter called Ode to Claire de Lune that come into play for a prodigy to go from child into maturity. You need to have a nurturing home environment. You need to be a human being first. It cannot just be a 24/7 isolation into just being a pianist. My mother, sadly, the term single mother wasn't known then, but she was a single mother, really struggling. And she was sort of put down by the jury, the local jury, because she was divorced in an era where women weren't divorced. So my talent meant everything to her. She lived vicariously. She was super ambitious and super smart. I mean, she cultivated the media like you wouldn't believe. That's probably how I got into the media. And very quickly, very, very early on, I realized my raison d'être in life was for her aggrandizement. My raison d'être was the piano to play so she could have entree into Jewish society. That's all. That's what it was about.
Your mother had quite a few issues, obviously, which is made clear from the book. Let's talk, though, before your parents actually split up. I mean, what kind of shape was your parents' marriage in as you grew up?
Well, we lived in this number 37 Mons Road, which is the opening chapter in this house with a north-south divide. And, well, their marriage was terrible. I mean, she would say, and she didn't, you know, hide it from me, that he would beat her, which he denied later. He didn't earn a living. It was just hopeless. It was really a terribly dysfunctional home, a terribly dysfunctional marriage. And the piano saved the day for everybody.
So your mother really saw you as the vehicle then for a ride out of this downtrodden life of single parenthood and downcast ostracism, it sounds like, from the Jewish community.
Yes, she saw me as a vehicle out. But I think the tragedy, at one point I viewed it as a tragedy, was I could only shine to a certain point. I said in the book, for her postage stamp visits of the world, I could not become a great artist. I could not reach the upper echelons because, as she once said, You mean you'd leave me when I wanted to go to the Juilliard? It had to only be in her little corner of the world because she could then manage it and shine and hold her head up in society. And that's what it was about. It wasn't about my becoming a great pianist.
You weren't the only child in the home, though, because
no,
you did have an older brother.
I have an older brother, yes.
And he apparently got much of mom's attention in your telling. And the anger still feels rather fresh in the book.
Does it?
It does.
I have no idea how it feels to the reader. I don't know what emotions.
Well, but it felt to you very, very annoying at the time. I mean, I'm using the wrong word here, I'm sure, but very hurtful, it sounds like, that he got a lot of the attention. But so was he explain
but
that
I then. I think that he felt he didn't get enough of the attention. He got the attention that, you know, he had to do well at school. She believed strongly in education. He became an accountant, a successful accountant. But the piano was the most important thing. He never came to any of my concerts. She treated him very well because she was very much into male patriarchy, male hierarchy. South Africa was very much into male patriarchy. It was very, very sexist. So I sometimes feel that my brother didn't get enough attention, and that's what caused all the problems later.
How did your parents' divorce hit you, and how old were you?
I was 10 when my dad left South Africa, and there's a chapter there that I call Your Father Left You on a Park Bench. I was practicing a Mozart rondo one afternoon where she literally vaulted over the balcony and came in and said, your father's left you. What? Apparently, he went off with a relative. He boarded ship and he went to America, and he didn't tell her, and he didn't even say goodbye to me. Well, he couldn't, I realize, in retrospect. And he just left and he emigrated to America, which was the best thing that could have happened to me because I was able to emigrate many, many years later. So it was just very sudden that he left.
But why did she say that he left you on a park bench? That was quite a way to word it.
Well, because the weekend before he left, he took me for a vanilla ice cream cone on a little bench outside a cafe. And we had the ice creams, and he never said a word that he was going to leave. I knew nothing. So that was her declaration. Your father left you on a park bench.
Was the image, I mean, you knew the truth of the story, though. I mean, did it make sense to you at
no,
that time?
No, it didn't, thank goodness. At the time, I kept thinking, huh? You know, 'cause he left her, obviously. But he also did, in a way, abandon his children.
So this is the world of 40-plus years ago, where obviously the contact was a lot slower. Once your father was out of the marriage and out of the country, did you have much or any contact with him?
My mother would absolutely—we weren't even allowed to say his name. I mean, it was verboten. You couldn't say father. You couldn't say Richard. I mean, she was very, very angry and very, very bitter. So there was absolutely no contact. And she said he didn't forward any child support, which she struggled so much, I tend to believe. And then all of a sudden, when I was about 18, she demanded that I write to Richard and ask for money. And then we started communicating, and he sent a very nice wedding present. And when I won a piano scholarship, ironically, the teacher, Obizerko, that I went to study with, lived in the Hollywood Hills. So, you know, I've stayed with my dad, and I'm very grateful for that time because I got to know him for 5 years.
What did your mom do? How did she support the family?
She was a secretary at a technical college downtown, but she earned, you know, mere pittance compared to everybody else.
Through the various episodes of turmoil and upset that you detail in the book, were you able, I mean, did you stay focused on the piano? And if so, how much? I mean, how much time did you spend at the piano?
My mother's mandate was that I had to practice 10 hours a day. I mean, that was her ruling. If you didn't practice 10 hours a day, it was slothful and lazy.
10 hours a day.
It was when I was in high school, it was started at 6:30 a.m. for a couple of hours. I'd go to school, come back, practice, study till like midnight. I was very gifted at school. And afterwards, I would practice 10 hours a day nonstop all day long. But I was very dedicated. I was very gifted.
And how rigorous were the pieces you were playing? I mean, how good were you by, say, 10 years old?
You've been playing for 5 years. Are you talking of when I was 10 years old?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I was already doing Mozart concerti and Beethoven and Bach but, you know, all the glitzy show pieces. The repertoire was just, everything was right there.
You mentioned this already and got into a section of the book that is really, really interesting to me, but this analysis of what it takes to go from prodigy to a mature mm-hmm. musical performer. And you mentioned that you have
yes.
to be a more complete human being. So what were the kinds of things that you weren't getting that might have helped this process along, that might have turned you into a more mature performer?
Well, for one thing, I wasn't getting nurtured. I wasn't getting loved. I was just practicing nonstop, performing. And it's not as if after every Astetfoto, every bursary, every concert, my mother would say, oh, my darling daughter, you did well. It wasn't nothing like that. She would get on the phone, call the relatives, Greta won this, and then say, go on, you useless thing, go and practice. You know, that was
that was her words?
Useless thing. I was just, you know, it's like, good morning, you know. Mm-hmm. So I just practiced. There was no gratification from that. There has to be the nurturing. She didn't have any use for anything else in life. I mean, you know, I sometimes marvel at the fact, and it may have been that South Africa was very backward culturally. I saw my first painting when I was 18. I went to the town of Kimberley, and there was a replica of the Blue Boy. And it's stunning to me now, you know, that there was just nothing. There were movies. She'd enjoy movies. We'd go to that. But there was just nothing to grow as a human being. There was none of that.
I hadn't been to an art museum at all until
No, but I don't think many people had in South Africa.
Mm-hmm. Greta Beagle's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called Kvetch, One Bitch of a Life, a memoir of music and survival about a life that appeared to be headed toward a career as a concert pianist and turned it a few different directions. We're just getting into that now. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley where Greta now lives, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Jeannie in Medford. Thanks for waiting, and welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Greta Beagle.
Hello, Greta. Hello, Jeffrey. When I was young, I was fortunate enough when we did live in housing projects, no matter how poor, family of eight, someone always had a piano. And I would tinker around and then got put in a convent type reform school at 12, and they sit you in the corner for 3 days. Well, luckily for me, there was a piano in the same room, so I would slip away and play by, I guess they call it hearing or...
Playing by ear?
Yes, and I would memorize when I'd watch someone play what's three black notes, what's two black notes, and the shapes of the one that looks similar, and I guess that's called playing by shape note. It was a wonderful experience. Then in Presbyterian Church at 13, which my parents attended, I go in the Sunday school building, which was separate than the main church, and leave the window propped with the rock in the bathroom. And during the main church service, I would slip out, crawl in the bathroom window into the Sunday school building all alone, and I could work out the songs I heard singing in the choir. Mm. So... But the only drawback I will say is when I play with other people now, they say, well, let's do this in the key of G. I'm like, okay, well, make one and I'll figure out where it is.
All right. Thanks for the stories of piano
You're welcome,
playing.
And thank you, Greta.
Thank you for calling in.
So tell us, I mean, did you play by ear? I'm curious about...
No. I never did. Mm-hmm. I would have to sight read, and I wasn't that great at it. I never played by ear. But I had the most incredible memory. I would memorize every single note. I spent a lot of time on that. And now I know it sounds very simplistic to concert pianists, but sometimes I marvel at, you know, the memory of playing concerti nonstop with, you know, just... never having a piece of music in front of me.
I always wonder about that when I see concert pianists at it, when they're playing these incredible pieces. And what was the most difficult piece that you played? I mean, did you get up to the Rachmaninoff 3, for example?
No. You see, I have very small hands, if you'll notice.
Oh, yes.
So my stretch was very limited. But, I worked around. I worked octaves. I mean, I was terrific. I did the Liszt number 1. I never got to the Rachmaninoff. I was thinking yesterday, I wish I would have done those flighty sort of Mendelssohn concerti because I had great facility and done some Chopin. But I really loved the Ravel G major, the jazzy, or the last movement. I was terrific at that.
For somebody like a Jeannie who just called, mm-hmm. I mean, the piano was a refuge to her.
Absolutely.
And
it saved
music
her.
Is a refuge for a lot of people. But this was your job in a sense, too.
Yes. You know, so many people have said to me, what do you mean you've given up the piano? Because I don't play anymore. I gave up the
Ever?
Piano. No, I never touched the piano.
Don't have one in your house?
No, because I do not want to practice anymore. I tried flirting with being a pianist again after my mother died. I was at the LA Times and people insisted I get a piano. And for some reason, it had to be white. I was like obsessed with wanting a white piano because I'd seen Liberace had had a white piano in Kalamazoo, Michigan, when I covered a festival. And I went on this mission to get a white piano, and I got one. I rented a little white Samick. And the funniest thing is when we had the L.A. earthquake in 1992, the piano fell over and landed on an ottoman. And I remember looking at this little upright thinking, oh, yeah, this is real sturdy, you know.
That was the Northridge quake?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a pretty bad one. So back to South Africa then, mm-hmm. and being around the piano. I mean, was South Africa at that time something of a backwater for truly great piano teachers?
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. Because first of all, there was a terrible stigma if you came to South Africa. We had a hideous reputation because of apartheid. And if you were a great pianist and a great piano teacher, why would, as I said in the book, why would you schlep all the way down to South Africa? What, except it was very beautiful and the climate was terrific. So they had some good pianists, but that's where I really fell short. I didn't have very good training. I think that might have made a very big difference.
You did have some tough teachers, though, as you recount in the book. Tell us about some of those.
I had this German teacher, Bridget Wild, and she trained with Claudia Arau, the piano great. And looking back, I believed in rigid finger articulation, which now we never do. It's a kiss of death, you know, with all the injuries you can get. And she would slap me on the back, one, two, three on the back. And she got really angry once because I said I wanted to learn Claire de Lune. This is in one of the chapters. Because my mother wanted Claire de Lune. See, my mother had no use for Bach or Beethoven. She just thought it was a big fat nuisance. She wanted Liszt and her Wunderkind could really shine. Mrs. Wild just had an absolute fit. She had no sense of humor. But I'll tell you something funny. Many years later, I looked her up in London. She was teaching at the Guildhall School of Music. And I was still nervous of her, you know. And I went into the house and she came with tea. And I don't know what happened. I couldn't stop sneezing. It was the most embarrassing thing. She said, God, Greta, you know.
She'd become allergic to her, it sounds like. Oh, that's amazing. So one of several tough teachers, it sounds like. But you include in the book some early reviews. I mean, how old were you when people were writing reviews of your work at the piano?
Oh, well, I'd play it and I'd Stedford, and they'd say I was a great pianist. Oh, the reviews came very quickly by the different critics. But my mother was very, very clever at that. As soon as I'd have a triumph, she'd contact the reporters and off we'd go to the newsrooms. I met more editors, more reporters. I was very, very comfortable then. I think this was the beginning.
Right, this is the beginning of your journalism career yourself, right?
Yeah, and then I would write stories and send in things and even send in jokes because I liked seeing my name in print.
So how old were you then when you went to the South African Broadcasting Corporation and you recorded in the studio there? And how old was that?
I think I was about, I think I was 57. I compared myself to Elvis. I think I was about 13. 12,
okay, so 13 years old and playing the piano.
Yeah, but I might have even been younger because I remember now sitting at the keyboard. They were doing many, many radio broadcasts. South African Broadcasting Corporation was terrific that way. Did a lot of recitals. You know, you could see the red button, the green button. It was very nerve-wracking.
Mm-hmm. So I meant to ask you then about what it was like to be on stage and performing, particularly with in the radio studio where everything has to happen right to the second.
Oh, right to the second, yeah. I didn't make mistakes. And I've posted on YouTube a set of variations by Glazunov that I did when I won a piano scholarship. And a friend of mine who's a pianist said, I'm astonished there's no wrong notes, you know, and it was just – so I put that up on YouTube for fun. It was nerve-wracking, but, you know, I was pretty much in control of what I was doing at that point. I would be nervous, I'd anticipated, but I became very nervous and had stage issues towards the end when I knew I was going to give up, the abuse was so bad, it was just impossible. You cannot separate a human being from the art. It's not one. You cannot have an abused, battered, bewildered, beaten woman going to be terrific on the concert stage. It's not possible.
You're not a machine.
No. I'll tell you one thing that really resonates with me still. I'm sure you're familiar with Julia Cameron, the author of The Artist's Way. She's done some very good work with creativity. I once went to one of her lectures because I was very tormented for years because I gave up the piano and I couldn't believe I'd done it. And I was saying, well, I'm not playing anymore. And she said something which still stays. She said, listen, you're not some little schmuck for your art, you know. You're a human being. And that's true.
It really does resonate, doesn't
Absolutely.
It? Absolutely. There's a fun side to this recording at the South African Broadcasting Corporation studios. You got a check for that.
Yes.
So what did you do with your first earnings?
I went and I bought an Elvis album because I worshipped Elvis. Elvis Presley was my god. And my mother went along with it thinking it was, you know, the norm, you know, that you'd go and Elvis. A lot of living to do. I remember that one. I went right away to get it. I worshipped Elvis.
Well, we had Elvis. We had Jerry Lee Lewis playing the piano. I mean, did you consider a change in your own genre as
no,
part of your
No, Elvis
piano
was god. Everybody mm-hmm. else was useless. Although I loved the fifth. Cliff Richard out of England was terrific. Tommy Steele. I mean, all of those people were in. They meant a lot to me.
Much more fun and much more hard living as well in Greta Beagle's book, Kvetch, One Bitch of a Life, a Memoir of Music and Survival. We'll come back and talk more with Greta, who now lives in Ashland, and we'll take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us back on the Jefferson Exchange with Greta Beagle and you in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Greta Beagle, who is now an Ashland resident, but started her life in South Africa as part of the Jewish community there. The book about her life as a would-be concert pianist and how that took a turn away from classical music is told in her memoir, Kvetch, One Bitch of a Life. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Well, let's go a little larger on context now, because we haven't talked much at all about your awareness of apartheid as a little girl. Mm-hmm, of course, mm-hmm. A little Jewish girl, but a little white Jewish girl mm-hmm. in South Africa. How aware were you of what was going on around you?
Well, growing up in South Africa with apartheid and segregation, we just accepted it. It was the norm. It was how we lived our lives. We didn't think about it. We didn't talk about it. We just grew up into womanhood. And then gradually we began to become aware. But there were little things that, on a very simplistic level, that I found strange. The woman who worked for my mother, Sophie Mputi, I called her Kwiki. She was my nanny. What I couldn't understand was, if you know, we'd get the flu a lot in Johannesburg because there was no heating to speak of. And she would, you know, take my mother's calls and really look after us all day long. But if she got ill, she had to come to work. She couldn't rest. And I remember I just didn't get it. I didn't quite understand it. And then there were strange things that the servants, in quotes, would have quarters at the back of the house or upstairs in an apartment building. And I remember my aunt was most indignant because they wanted hot water. So there were little things like that you began to become aware of. And you all day long, you were aware of prejudice. Prejudice ruled in South Africa. It was whites against blacks. It was Xhosa against Sotho, against Bantu. It was Jews, German Jews against Polish Jews. It was the British against the ruling Afrikaners. I mean, nobody liked anybody. That's my take on it. Now, some of my other school friends might beg to differ because they love Africa. But when you have government-mandated prejudice and hatred, it's free to spread throughout all the environs, and it did.
Well, as Jews, was there any extra sensitivity to the plight of non-whites in the Jewish community?
We were aware of it, and we would say things like, you know, we should be more sensitive. But I think the Jews merely went along with the status quo for a very long time. There were Jewish activists, but I wasn't close to them. I wasn't familiar with them. I know they made efforts. But the Jews, and I can only speak for the Jews because I was part of the Orthodox community, we went along with the status quo and lived very nice lives. Some of the relatives, we didn't, but they did.
Did Jews ever have any fear of the government or police in South Africa at that
Absolutely,
time?
Absolutely, because I left I won a scholarship and I left in 68 the first time and then migrated to America in 1970, became a citizen. But, it was too terrible, the knocking on the door. There was a 90-day detention act, and then when I left, there was a terrorism act. There was the immorality act. A white man couldn't be seen driving his black servant back to the township because he'd get arrested. I mean, there were 90, you could be held without trial. It was pounding on the doors, middle of the night raids. It was really a dangerous time. was hideous.
You mentioned having some extended family there. I mean, how much comfort or support were they? I mean, because here's you and your mother and your brother in a fairly small flat, and you shared a bedroom with your mother, as you point out through
the
book, for pretty much
my entire time, yes.
So the extended family, how much comfort or support to you in this difficult time of your life?
You mean now or then?
Then.
Oh, there was no support. That was the problem. That's why my mother had to live through me and the music, because they were very contemptuous of her. She didn't have money. And my uncle, Louis, who's in the book, was very, very wealthy. There were a lot of very, very wealthy South African Jews. They were very astute, very smart, made a lot of money. And he was contemptuous of her. There was no support. There was very little support. And I sometimes look back and I say to him, had there been love for her or caring or a minimal of support, I think things would have been very different.
So she was essentially frozen out of her own family.
Yes.
And took it out on, well, essentially you, it sounds like.
Yes. And this, the relatives were really, they were pianists. You know, I have a cousin who I see in London, and she's a good pianist. She played, and it was such a shock because I met her in San Diego, and she played a piece, and she banged just as much as she used to bang at the piano, and it took everything not to start laughing, you know.
Well, so you were that good that you could really notice the differences in other people's techniques
and
the weaknesses in them, I should say.
Oh, yeah, I was very good. But, you know, that was very difficult for me because I wanted to be part of a music community. I wanted to share. I wanted to. And my mother put me up on this platform that they would all be jealous. And it was very, very difficult for me. It was not of my doing.
So, as we pointed out already, it wasn't like you got much of release or comfort at the piano. It really was
no,
your job.
And I think chamber music is such a joy for everybody. I mean, that would have been wonderful for me to participate in music making and to have this love of it forever. It would have been fabulous, but it was not to be. I was isolated. And again, I honestly believe to be a great artist, you cannot live in isolation.
We've already talked about how crazy you were for Elvis. You took your first check for playing the piano at the South African Broadcasting Corporation and bought an Elvis record. Another event, though, in here, you described getting the news of John F. Kennedy's assassination.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously a big deal in the United States, but you were South African, living in South Africa at the time. Why such a big deal to you and your friends?
Well, you have to realize that some of these outposts, these colonies, worshipped all things American. I think that's what kept me going and led to my survival. I wanted to get to America more than anything.
You knew your father was there, right?
But that wasn't the reason. Mm-hmm. It was. I mean, I was absolutely entranced with Van Cliburn winning the Tchaikovsky International and the ticker tape parade. And I'd sit in that patio looking at pictures and looking at pictures of Elvis looking all sexy, you know. And it was, I just wanted to be in America. And we would devour the latest rock and roll. Rock and roll was enormous in South Africa. And we would devour the latest records, I mean, the latest news from all over the world. We had a British perspective as well, which Americans probably didn't have as much of. Cliff Richard, Tommy Steele. I mean, we were really into this. This was our lives as teenagers.
Hmm. You got engaged to Ralph, your first husband, at a very early age, actually, it seems like. But not early enough from your mother's perspective, it sounds like.
No, it wasn't early, because if you're Jewish and 21 in South Africa, not married, you might as well have called it quits. I mean, you had to be married at 21, otherwise. And I just made the deadline about 3 days. So it wasn't considered young then.
Really? And how long did the marriage to Ralph last?
The marriage was a disaster for about a year from start to finish. And that still, after all these years, upsets me. Not as much as it did, because, you know, he moved on. He's done very well as an oncologist back east. I was recognized by Clinton. He's got a new family. I did speak to him once on the phone. But I mourn that, because it had nothing to do with me. It was all controlled by my mother. And that's what makes me very sad, because I think I really liked the guy.
It sounds like you did. I mean, it was definitely a wistful set of feelings, and you had some good times together. So did you move back into the bedroom with your mother when the marriage to Ralph was over?
Yes.
Wow.
But I'll tell you something that gave me comfort. I was telling a reporter at the LA Times once, I was going on and on how sad I was about it, and he looked at me. He said, you know, maybe you should stop blaming yourself, because if you would have been my wife, I sure as hell wouldn't have let you get away. I would have just confronted her and then. But Ralph was very gentle. He was an intern. He was a very quiet guy and a very gentle guy, a highly cultured guy, and he wasn't equipped for her. I don't know anybody who was.
You mentioned envying a cousin and some other people who traveled outside of South Africa. How old were you? I mean, given your talent, you should have been traveling around the world, it seems like. But how old were you when you first did get out of South Africa?
I think after the divorce, I won a scholarship through sheer savvy. I deemed myself eligible and wrote a brilliant essay when I look back on it, and I won a piano scholarship. And that's when I came to L.A. was the first time. And, oh, man, we lived near Hollywood Boulevard, and I would just pinch myself every day. You know, I'd go there.
So L.A., wow, how big a culture shock was that for you? Or was it something you'd prepared for, you felt like, most of your life?
I think I'd prepared for it most of my life. I mean, I was really ready.
Well, but this was your first chance to actually spend time with your father since you were 10 years old.
Yes.
And what was that like?
In the beginning, it was very strange because I had all her hideous messages. But then
hideous messages about how bad he'd been?
Yeah, about how horrible he was. Now, the thing that was absolutely true about him is he wouldn't spend a penny on anything. I mean, and I think he really thought he did well by escaping, not having to support his children. He thought, he made out, you know, he thought that was terrific. But apart from that, he was a very interesting guy. And of course, I mourn that. I've written a letter to him. You know, if I could have been more open to him. For example, he wanted me to go to high holiday services with him. And I didn't want to do it because I was annoyed yet to buy tickets in America, whereas other places you got in for free. And I mourn that I didn't do it. He loved the arias. He'd sit Saturday mornings and listening to Pavarotti. And, you know, I'm sorry we didn't go to more concerts if he was alive and I was getting all those tickets. When I was at the LA Times, if you covered a certain beat, you got tickets to all the concerts. They're very strict about that. And I got tickets to the greatest concerts. And I really wish he could be with me now. I used to call him Yankala and he'd call me Kukala. And it was a lot of fun. Music is what we really shared.
There, you ended up at least getting to get together with a piano teacher, one you really wanted to work with in L.A. Mm-hmm. What did that, and who was that?
Obi Cerco. He was.
Oh, you mentioned him already. Okay. And what did he think of your talent? What did he think of your prospects?
Well, what was interesting is he accepted me as a student based on a tape recording that I'd sent from South Africa of my scholarship recital. It was very exciting for me. And I went to him, and he met with me and he said, you could have a career, but it would be a secondary career in America.
I noticed that term. I'd never heard that before.
And I thought to myself, And a friend of mine said, are you crazy? Do you know how marvelous that is? What would, you know? I don't think too much had gone wrong. Like I was barely functional. And I don't think at that point I could have had a top tier career. I mean, you know, it's enormous to be a concert pianist. But a secondary career, what does it mean? I'm not sure. He said he could get me a scholarship to UCLA, potentially. You get a scholarship and you teach, and there's so much you can do nowadays with the change in technology. It's fabulous. I mean, YouTube, you could do anything online. You could teach online. You can help young people. You can educate. It would have been enormous. Now there's enormous avenues, but I'm not quite sure what would have happened. But I couldn't sustain it anymore. I was much more interested standing on a corner seeing Bobby Kennedy arriving. I mean, I was thrilled.
And you actually did see Bobby on his last visit to Los Angeles?
Yeah, it was absolutely. I shut the piano lid and went, stood on the corner, and oh my God, I thought he was a god. And then I remember my father came in at 2 a.m. banging on my door, and he said, Kukala, Kukala, your Bobby's dead. It was like so shocking.
That sounds like it really sort of closed a chapter in America for you, too, or at least at that point in time.
What do you mean closed?
Well, I mean, was that the end of your time in America? That was your first visit,
Oh, no,
right?
No. That was my first visit. And then I went back, believe it or not, to South Africa for a year.
And why?
Why? I think it's the hope that thing was changed because I had changed so much. And I mentioned that in the book, the actor Frances Farmer did that. And she went back, and by the time her mother finished with her, but nothing had changed. Of course, it was 20 times worse. But then I immigrated forever in 1970 and became a citizen and then became a journalist and I never abandoned America.
At what point in there did you just say, that's it, I'm not doing the piano anymore? Was there a specific moment? I mean, there was a time where you just shut the piano and never went back?
Mm-hmm. I was studying with Obi Cerco, and I was having a lot of problems with the Revolutionary Etude by Chopin. I just couldn't get it. It was just, I knew it was like flogging a horse. It was over for me. And I had my father, it was great. He called him and said, she's not coming back, which was really great of him to do that. And at that point, I said, that's it. And my mother, of course, was shocked, absolutely shocked. But she was so out of touch that about 10 years later, we spoke on the phone. I was in LA, and she said, if you would come back and practice 10 hours a day, you could be back on top. And then I just realized.
She was holding on to a dream that
it was just so over.
Hmm. Did you reach any sort of detente with her in the later years of her life?
No, nothing. It was not possible.
Simply no prospect for that?
No. I think what did me the most harm was I believed she loved me, and she would tell me she was the greatest mother on earth. And that's very damaging, because if you know the truth that someone's incapable of it, or that, you know, we didn't know the term abuser there. We didn't know sexual abuser. They knew nothing. If you know the truth, I think you can go after a healing and a cure. But if you believe someone's perfect and they loved you, and then it all goes wrong, it just leaves you floundering.
Your career in journalism, a dozen years with the Los Angeles Times, and, yes, and a few extra years as a freelancer after that. I mean, was it just a natural sort of environment for you after all those years around reporters when you were the focus of the story?
Yes. You know, incredibly looking back, I think my destiny, and despite the pianistic talent, I wanted to be a journalist. Because when I was a little, from about age 8, I'd get the Daily Mail, the Evening Star, and then the Sunday, and I'd compare coverage. You think, oh, no, he missed that. Oh, no, this is no good. I'd phone up the editors and tell them what they missed. I think I was extremely interested in journalism from a very young age.
And you made a successful career out of it.
Yeah, I made a career out of it. Now, you know, it was a privilege working at the LA Times, because I got to interview so many fabulous people. It was just, but it was very painful at the same time. I would interview these great pianists, and then I'd come home and realize what I'd abandoned, what I'd given up. I mean, now I really don't care, but for a long time, I really did mourn my music.
There is a lot to take in the book, and believe me, there are whole parts of the book we didn't even touch on, but yes, the book is called Kvetch, One Bitch of a Life, A Memoir of Music and Survival. Ashlyn's Greta Beagle is the author and our guest. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you for having me. It was fun.
You bet. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about new earthquake maps indicating where the danger areas are on the southern Oregon coast. At 8:30, we'll talk about the rural counties in Oregon getting together to talk about possible remedies for the funding crises going on in several counties around the state. At 9 o'clock, we'll talk to some people about guiding entrepreneurs into successful businesses in the Rogue Valley. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant is Megan Mercier. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.